So our next argument is Teed versus Thomas and Betts. Mr. Voss.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please this Court. My name is Andrew Voss. I'm here this morning to speak on behalf of Thomas and Betts Power Solutions on appeal of judgments issued in the Western District of Wisconsin awarding overtime to 25 individual field engineers formerly employed by the predecessor, J.T. Packard, whose assets were purchased by my clients out of receivership. Your Honor, my comments this morning focus on the creation of a new federal rule, an issue of first impression in the circuit under the Fair Labor Standards Act, that deemed my client a bona fide purchaser of assets in receivership as a successor for the purpose of imposing overtime liability under the Fair Labor Standards Act. This Court has had occasion to comment on that federal successorship rule on a number of occasions in other substantive statutory contexts, but has not done so under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and there are very good reasons, Your Honors, that there is no reason to impose such a rule under the FLSA. Your Honor, there are really three ways that any court will get to the imposition of this federal successorship rule under any statute. First, as the Supreme Court said repeatedly over the last decade or so, the courts must look to the statute itself. This is a question of statutory interpretation. What has Congress said about who is liable for overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act? The language in the FLSA in Section 216B is very specific with respect to alleged violations of Section 206 and 207, the minimum wage and overtime provisions of the statute. Employers are liable for such violations of the statute. Now, the definition of employers is very broad. This court has said so.
Well, how is that different from the employment, from Title VII? That's about employers, too.
Certainly, Your Honor, but there's much broader remedies available under Title VII. Courts are authorized.
What do you mean with the term employer, though?
Your Honor.
I don't think this is your good argument. I think you have a better argument. My question for you is, if Packard's assets hadn't been bought, if Packard had survived, because Packard was a profitable company, suppose Packard were still around, would these workers have been able to get anything, or would the bank take priority?
If there had been, absolutely, Your Honor, Imperial Canadian Bank had priority over all other creditors, and they would have simply sold off the assets piecemeal.
That's the point, that these employees that they're really asking for a windfall, because if they weren't arguing successor liability, if there were no successor, they'd have no remedy against their employer.
That's true, Your Honor. I would add to that argument, however, that by encouraging the purchase of these assets out of receivership by a successor that takes them free of clear, that actually supports one of the fundamental purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that is to increase employment. This statute is decades old, and it represents a significant compromise on both sides.
You're not going to get anywhere there, because the cases have made clear, the general to the federal common law rule of successor liability is broad, and it seems to extend to all federal statutes. And there isn't that much difference between the FLSA and Title VII and the others. But I think you have a stronger point, because I think the problem for these employees is that whatever these transactions were, that once the bank made this big loan and was the senior creditor, there was no way that any of these other creditors, including these workers, weren't going to get anything.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. That's absolutely right. And the question then was whether J.T. Packard was going to continue business as an ongoing concern under different ownership, so that the subsequent successor, the purchaser of those assets, could dedicate those assets to their best use. And in fact, a number of these plaintiffs were hired by the new J.T. Packard after the assets were purchased out of receivership. So from my perspective, again, I understand the court deems it not to be our strongest argument, but that supports one of the fundamental purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Certainly, as your Honor noted, the federal successor rule has been applied in a number of different contexts. But in this circuit, that has only been true in two substantive contexts, and that is ERISA and civil rights. And there are fundamentally different public policy considerations that animate both of those statutes. As this court said in Artistic Furniture, affirmed in Moriarty post-Atherton, there was a fundamental federal interest in ensuring consistency across the states in terms of how the courts develop rules that determine how contributions to pensions were going to be managed. And there was a fundamental disconnect between the application of a state law rule here in Illinois in Moriarty that would mean that the other employers that might be participating in a multi-employer pension plan, for example, would have to cover up for that delinquent predecessor employer. So there were public policy reasons as to why this court deemed the creation of a federal successorship rule to be important to public policy as articulated in ERISA. The same is true in the civil rights cases. This court has repeatedly identified, as other courts have identified, going back to the Sixth Circuit in McMillan-Bloedel. First of all, the court in McMillan-Bloedel in the Sixth Circuit looked to the statute itself. What does Title VII provide in terms of a remedy? The statute provides that courts may engage in affirmative action and issue equitable relief to ensure that these bias violations are remedied. So there is a broad...
What's the difference between that and the FLSA?
Your Honor, there is a difference with respect to violations of the overtime and minimum wage provisions in 206-207. If you compare the second sentence of 216B with the first sentence of 216B, the first sentence reflects the remedies available for a violation of the overtime and minimum wage violations, or minimum wage obligations, which restricts to those remedies only. There's no language about equitable relief or affirmative action to ensure that the complaint is made whole. But if you can compare that with the second sentence.
Well, of course, because look, with FLSA, it's just money. You have a minimum wage and you have overtime, and you just compute what is owed. So you would rarely need equitable relief. Well, you certainly could get it.
Well, Your Honor, but in the second sentence of that...
I don't understand. Are you saying FLSA not as important a statute?
Your Honor, I don't deem one statute to be more important than the other, and neither has Congress.
It's a different generation. You know, it's the 30s versus the 60s.
And they address completely different public policy issues.
I understand. They're not completely different. They're both about protecting employees. In one case, protecting employees against being underpaid. In another case, about protecting employees, sometimes about being underpaid, sometimes not being hired at all, on the basis of race. Well, those are different grounds for discriminating against employees, for violating employee rights, why would you distinguish in terms of successive liability?
Your Honor, because this court has distinguished between the types of remedies that are available under both.
All the statutes I know where this issue has arisen, all the federal statutes, the courts say, this is the federal common law of successive liability applies. And certainly it's much simpler to use the one rule, the federal common law rule, for all the federal statutes rather than saying, this statute different than that statute. What's
In those cases where there has been a considered effort to interpret the statute, as the Supreme Court has dictated, you have to find...
You just want to complicate the law. I don't get it.
Your Honor, what the Supreme Court has said, you have to look to the statute, exactly as the Supreme Court did in Golden State.
The statutes are extremely similar. Look, what is it you're gaining by this? What are you doing for commerce or the economy or what? What's the gain from using the state rather than the federal common law successive liability?
Well, the state law complements the FLSA as it's permitted.
What are you gaining from using the state rule instead of the federal rule?
To the extent you have corporate actors that act as the plaintiffs implied in their briefing, to shuffle their liabilities and engage in fraud in order to avoid responsibility for their overtime obligations, there are specific exceptions in Wisconsin state law, as in most state laws, that allow
state employment racial employment discrimination laws before there were federal laws. So why don't you make the same argument?
The question, Your Honor, however, is whether the state law complements.
You're completely. This is extremely artificial. You haven't identified any practical reason for complicating the law by carving out the FLSA.
It's not complicated, Your Honor.
You're preoccupied with this terrible argument. You've got a good argument, which you barely mention, and instead you're off in this dreamland of parsing statutes.
Simply because the Supreme Court said that that's where you have to start to determine what types of rights and remedies.
They start, and everywhere they finish in the same place, despite the statute, right?
No, Your Honor.
Title VII. Are there federal statutes they've held are not subject to the federal common law rule?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has
interpreted. Not.
This court has interpreted.
Has the Supreme Court held that there's a statute to which the federal common law of successive liability doesn't apply?
Your Honor, in an analogous circumstance,
no,
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has not addressed this issue since Golden State in the 1970s. What the Supreme Court has done in repeated occasions throughout the last two decades is analogized other circumstances where the plaintiffs have attempted to expand those culpable parties under these states.
So you gave me a reason why it would be bad to apply the federal rule to FLSA, then I'd listen to you. Is there a reason? Something gets screwed up as a result of using the federal rule rather than a state rule?
Well, this was settled law, Your
Honor.
Something
bad happened.
Yes, Your Honor.
What?
The assets are purchased. This was unknown liabilities. The purpose of the receivership proceeding, as
that
acknowledged by...
That could happen in a Title VII case or an ERISA case, right?
There were fundamental policy, overriding policy considerations that this court identified in Muziki Wamba.
No, you'd have the identical argument. You have the identical argument in the case where there was a senior creditor, and as a result, that just wasn't money for these other people, right? You'd have that in all these cases.
Your Honor, and the court grounded its extension of the common law rule.
You'd have it in all these cases. The same argument would be available, right? You have a Title VII case. You have discriminating against employees. They're asking for monetary relief, and the defendant points out, look, we'd love to give it to you, but we have these senior creditors, and what they're owed exceeds everything we could give you.
Your
That'd
Honor,
be the identical argument, right?
And this court
and it
ground,
would succeed.
This court grounded its conclusion
and it
in
would succeed,
the,
wouldn't it?
The public policy considerations are different that animate the statute.
No, if you have a senior creditor, you don't have any money for these plaintiffs. It doesn't matter what statute they're suing under.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Your Honor.
Unless you're going to turn around all the bankruptcy priorities, right? You're
absolutely right. I'll reserve my time.
Mr. Johnson?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Thomas and Beth's argument today ignores the state court's receivership order. Not only did that order say the purchaser was on notice, but that order also says that nothing in this order or the purchase agreement shall bar or otherwise prohibit the plaintiffs in the wage and hour actions from asserting any and all claims. It was not an excluded liability. The state court in the receivership order, which approved the sale, said that it could not. This court explained in Moriarty that the broader approach to successor liability is this circuit's current approach. Nothing in the cases that Thomas and Betts has cited has overturned or required this court to change its direction in these cases.
But what about the problem of the bank loan, the bank priority?
Your Honor, I believe the that gets worked out when there's notice, and the market will work properly and ensure that these plaintiffs would receive the value of their work.
I don't understand. If they're subordinate creditors and there isn't enough money to go around, then they don't get anything, right?
There have been two prior cases before.
This is not a matter of prior cases. This is a matter of simple bankruptcy law, right? The senior creditor gets the money first. If there's nothing left over for the other people, that's tough luck, right?
A couple comments on that, Your Honor. J.T. Packard was not in bankruptcy. J.T. Packard had $5 million in profits in 2009, the year before the sale. J.T. Packard was a profitable company, and that profit is off of the backs of these employees.
But Packard was sold so that the bank would be repaid, right?
That is correct. And also in this case,
after the bank is repaid, is there money left over for the workers?
No, there is not.
I don't know what your case is.
In Artistic Furniture, this exact same.
Talk about a case. Talk about these facts. Now, Packard is sold, and the money has to go to the bank because it's the senior creditor, and there's nothing left for these people. And
the successor liability doctrine takes care of that because it requires notice and it allows for the proper allocation of this liability, and it places it on the.
I don't understand. Does it change the bankruptcy priority rules?
No, but this matter was not in bankruptcy either.
Yes, I know. It's receivership, but they have their own rules, which are like the bankruptcy rules. I didn't think anyone was debating the proposition that the bank had the prior claim to Packard's assets.
But what I'm saying, Your Honor,
is that correct? It had the prior claim.
Yes, it had a secured claim.
So what does successive liability, have to do with this case?
Because
there isn't enough money to go around, and this bank has the whip hand and gets all the money.
The amount of money that the bank received in the sale of these assets took into account the proper valuation of the liability. At auction, the price was achieved at auction by the three parties bidding on the assets and taking into account this liability. Okay, so that liability is already it's in there. It's in the purchase price. The market worked efficiently because Thomas and Betts had notice. Okay,
I don't understand what notice does. How is the bank affected by notice?
The bank is not affected by it. Well, the bank is affected by notice.
How much is the bank owed?
My understanding is that the loan was for somewhere around $60 million. I don't know what else the bank.
Million,
yes,
right.
I don't know what else the bank received.
The assets are $22 million.
J.T. Packard was not the only asset. There were other assets.
Did the bank get its $60 million?
I'm not sure what the bank received.
So how do you know whether there's any money left over for your clients? Bank is owed $60 million. Packard is worth only $22
million. On SR Bray's loan, the bank is owed $60 million. This is one of the assets that was used to pay off that loan.
I know, but if the point is if the bank has not been paid in full, there's no money for your clients. It doesn't have anything to do with successive liability.
But the federal policy...
liability.
The,
but that's why I asked you, does the federal policy upend the bankruptcy or the state equivalent receivership priority rules? You said no.
The federal policy is strong enough to ensure that these employees are paid.
Not at the expense of a senior creditor, unless you think the federal common law rule of successive liability changes bankruptcy priorities, and it shouldn't. The point about successor liability is that you can't get rid of your obligations to the workers by selling your company. Well, that's what it amounts to.
Your Honor,
I don't see how that's involved here in a case where the employer is broke, right?
The employer is not broke.
It's that the employer's assets are owned by someone else,
right,
namely the bank. And therefore, the employer, whether it's successor or predecessor, it just doesn't have any assets it can give the workers.
Right. The bank chose to go the auction route. The bank chose not to go into bankruptcy. The bank was operating the company. And if they wanted to continue to operate that company and get as much value out of it as they wanted, they would have done that. There's nothing in the record that if a judgment would have been entered prior to the sale, that the bank wouldn't have paid it. They would have had to pay it to have a clean sale. I want to get these two cases out there because in Artistic Furniture, the same exact circumstance happened. The bank had foreclosed on the loan and sold the assets. Okay, in Chicago Truck, the predecessor employer was actually in bankruptcy, yet this court still applied the doctrine of successor liability.
It's not that the doctrine doesn't apply to bankrupt firms. That's not the point. That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
And as you said, Packard wasn't bankrupt. The point is, it's a very, very simple point, which is that if there are senior creditors, there may not be money left over for the workers. That's as simple as that. And you haven't identified a source of money that would be available to these workers that wouldn't be part of the bank's claim.
In applying the doctrine of successor liability, the court looks at whether or not the predecessor could pay. And I think it's not in dispute that J.T. Packard as a company doesn't have any assets.
It couldn't pay
now
with money that was the entitlement of another creditor. See, it can't do that. It can't say, the bank comes along and says, look, you owe us $60 million. You have $22 million in assets. And the debtor can't say, well, fine, I'm going to give $1 million for the workers. You can have the other $21 million. That doesn't work because the bank has a prior claim that's larger than the assets of the debtor.
There's nothing in the record. We don't know why the bank gave a loan for $60 million on this. Made this loan. I don't know what other assets were at issue, but
why they made the loan. Is there any question that the bank has a claim to all of Packard's assets?
That's what the bank chose to. Yes, the bank came in, took the assets, and chose to sell those assets
to it. So I don't know what's left for the workers.
What's left for the workers is the portion of the sales price that Thomas and Betts did not pay because they had notice of this asset. The bank already received less money because in determining the value of these assets at market, they had notice of this liability, and Thomas and Betts already paid less because they factored that into their sales price.
But that can't bind the bank. You can't have a debtor who says to his senior creditor, "Well, actually, no. We're giving our money to a junior creditor." Right? You can't do that.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the bank already received the full value of what the market would hold for this set of assets. And that full value was sold at a lower value because the parties at
auction... But then that's not the full value.
Right. So
money has been reserved for the workers. That's not full value. So as I say, the creditor doesn't say, well, you've reserved money for a junior creditor, so I guess I'm left with... I'm just...
But that's what happens at auction. At auction, the value was determined of what the market would hold. And that
so
market would...
Did the bank say, well, fine, you know, we're happy?
The bank was happy with whatever money they were going to receive out of this
deal. No, that's not true. They're only happy with what they're entitled to. And if the auction doesn't... If the auctioneer gives some of the money that should have gone to the bank to someone else, bank is not happy.
Well, the effect of the auction is that the price was such that it included an understanding that this liability would go forward.
Did the bank agree that they're going to give up their claim to that money that was going to go to junior creditors?
The bank agreed to that when they decided to auction to come in and put the matter in receivership rather than bankruptcy and to auction the assets, yes. I think the court's concern here is rooted in a situation that is not this situation, where the assets that are available do not exceed the potential liabilities. If that is the case, then yes, it's truly a windfall to the plaintiffs. But that's not the situation here, because the assets had substantial value, and that value was arrived at or built upon these employees working without receiving their overtime pay. And Thomas and Betts is here arguing one last time, hopefully, that this is something that they shouldn't have to pay, even though they spent 2 years defending themselves and not asking for an interlocutory appeal upon the court's original order. In conclusion, Your Honors, the court should continue its use of the broader approach to successor liability. There's no case or precedent that would require this court not to follow its prior longstanding precedent in these cases.
And if we didn't, would we be creating a conflict with the Ninth?
It would be creating a conflict with the Ninth Circuit, yes, Your Honor. I'd like to emphasize again, notice ensures that these liabilities would be paid, and that is factored into the purchase price that has already been agreed to.
The other thing is, if we rule favorably for the plaintiff, we'll have to overrule our Wamba case. It's got the three-prong test that's normally applied.
That's correct.
In these situations.
That is correct. And that case has been followed and cited throughout the country. Are there any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much for your time.
Boss?
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make sure that if the court has any questions about that transaction, because the court was focused on that issue, opposing counsel indicated that there was an accommodation for the exposure presented by this class action litigation during the auction. There's simply no record of that. In fact, the receiver indicated that the exposure would not follow the transaction. The court order specifically indicated that the exposure would not transfer. The parties to the transaction, that is, the principals at J.G. Packard and Thomas and Betts, and Mr. Fonville's declaration is in the record, the clear understanding was that the exposure to these class actions would not transfer with a sale. So there's no basis whatsoever to indicate that there was some accommodation in terms of how the bidding process proceeded in the receivership proceeding that somehow accommodated for this exposure.
Well, you were not aware of this claim?
Your Honor, we were certainly aware of the litigation.
Well,
it was ongoing, but there was no accommodation because everyone to that transaction.
When you made your bid, you might have factored that in, right?
Your Honor, the record is clear that that was not factored in because all the parties to the transaction.
How do we know that?
all the parties.
I mean, you offer a price, right?
Your Honor, absolutely.
We don't get behind how you arrived at that, do we?
There's declaration testimony in the record as to how they arrived at that price, and there was no, since all the parties to the transaction and the receiver.
Well, how do you factor in pending litigation when you make a bid?
Well, if you have no way to liquidate the claim, you have no understanding as to how much it's worth, and all the parties to the transaction advise that the asset or the liability will not transfer with the transaction, there's no reason to accommodate that exposure.
Well, parties may agree to that, but that's only subject to what may evolve in a court.
Subject to what may happen as in a case of first impression in this circuit, absolutely.
Well, I understand that. So, but in assessing what to bid, you don't disregard the possibility of unfavorable litigation.
All they can do is assess the facts as they're presented during the transaction itself. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Boston.